Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to episode number 367 of the Peristyle Podcast. Today is April 20th, 2015. We've got a big show for you this week on the podcast. Coach Harvey Hyde's on secret assignment, so we're going to do a Dan Weber and Ryan Abraham show. The whole show, just USCFootball.com beat writer Dan Weber and myself. We have a lot of questions to get to. Stuff about the team, stuff about this Todd McNair case. No one knows it better than our own Dan Weber, so we're just going to bring him on. Dan, what's going on, buddy? How you doing?
Pretty good. Enjoying the first week after spring ball and starting to look ahead. I'm kind of taking a look at the schedule, which I'll have a piece up tomorrow as to how the, you know, this is the time of year when you're actually allowed and encouraged to look ahead, and you don't have to take them one game at a time. So, it's going to kind of try to play. I think it was interesting that ESPN came out with their the Fast and Info people that you've dealt with, and they analyzed all of the non-conference schedules for the next 5 years. And I think 85% of the non-conference games were set. And the top four schedules in terms of difficulty in the country, Texas was barely number one. Number two, three, and four were USC, Stanford, and UCLA. So USC is, even if people say, oh, my gosh, you know, Arkansas State and Idaho, for the next 5 years, right now, USC has the second most difficult non-conference schedule. So that's something to, you know, when you look ahead, you know, they've just, in the Pac-12, three of the top four difficult schedules are in the Pac-12.
Yeah, certainly, and it'll be interesting to watch how this unfolds. Like you mentioned, those two games that should be fairly easy, but of course, Alabama coming, playing USC in 2016. A lot of people are already talking about that. So it'll be, and Notre Dame, of course, every year. It depends how well they do, but that'll be interesting to keep an eye on. But usually, the Pac-12 schools have those highly ranked schedules.
And I was telling people the reason Texas is number one probably is because they took USC up.
Oh, yeah, down.
To be honest. It helped Texas out, too.
Yeah, certainly. Well, Dan,
wants that kind of help, but, yeah. but that's the so kind of interesting when you think about it, and that USC, you know, getting Notre Dame every year, you know, it does change things. And if you get Notre Dame and a Texas in the same year, that's just unheard of. I mean, nobody else plays, you know, two games like that.
Yeah, I mean, 2016 will be Notre Dame and Alabama in the same year. You know, they played for the national championship in 2012. So it's like people forget that, Dan. When people talk about the schedule, they never seem to mention, well, they also play Notre Dame. It's almost like it's a conference game, but it's yeah. Not, you know. People feel like that.
No, it's in addition to the nine-game conference schedule, you know, where, again, that is something they don't do. And the other conferences, you know, they may talk about it, you know, like maybe they'll do it, but they don't do it yet. So, and not only that, but then a championship game. So, you know, to win the Pac-12, we basically have to win 10 conference games.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to jump in here. We have a lot of questions, like I said. And if you have any questions for us, you can email us podcast@uscfootball.com is the email address, or you can call leave a voicemail at 206-888-6755, or you can leave a voicemail right on our website, peristylepodcast.com. Click on the left side of the page, right from your computer, you can leave us a voicemail. And we do have a lot of questions to get to, Dan. I think we're going to start off talking about some spring ball stuff, and then I think after that we'll talk about the we didn't get to talk to it last week because there were so many questions about the spring game that, of course, last Saturday or, you know, a week and a half ago or whatever it was. But we did have a lot of Todd McNair NCAA questions that we are kind of rolling over into this week. So we got a lot to get to, but we'll start with the team first. And here's our first question.
Hi, Ryan. This is Al from Fresno. Went to the spring game. Didn't see much, but I talked to the guys afterwards, and the guys seemed really excited. I'm impressed with the talent level that we have here. There's so many big names and so many people that can produce for the team. My only concern is the coaching. Is the coaching going to put the talent on the team and give them the best opportunity to win, or is it going to play close to the vest? Really, truthfully, I think we need a more dynamic coaching team that's willing to open the playbook, utilize all the talent, put them all in the field. Like I told Soma Vunuku, if they gave the opposing team a steady diet of Penner and Vunuku and soften up that defense and then bring in Justin Davis, you know, to bust open those holes, you know, I think we would be a more powerful team. I'd like to know what the coach thinks. Thanks.
Well, I'll answer for the coach here. I think, you know, the thing that bothered you a little bit about the spring game was the first couple of times they tried to power run the football in the red zone or goal line or third down and two, that kind of thing. They just got, you know, somebody nice through and, you know, stopped the play before it really got started. I think they have to, you know, to be dynamic, I think they really do have to be able to, you know, power block. And they've got to be able to block for, you know, for Justin or for Trey or for, you know, Soma. You know, whether it's you know, the average size back or the big back or the really big back, they've got to figure out, you know, how not to allow those plays to break down. Again, it wasn't, you know, tackling, so you don't get a great great look at things. And I know, you know, with just the one true tailback and the defensive line basically having just a couple of guys that figure in the rotation. That was not a matchup that they decided to go through, you know, go with a lot. But I would have liked to have seen more of that. Whether that's more dynamic coaching or whatever it is, I just think they, you know, they have to, they're saying all the right things, and I think they're doing the right things in practice, but they have to do the, you know, the right things at the end of games, and they have to believe in themselves. They have to believe that, you know, when they line up with UCLA, that UCLA is the team that's going to get, you know, physically run off the field. And they've got to stop, you know, ever letting anybody intimidate them physically. I think that is the big part of it. I think they'll open the playbook. I don't think that's a problem. I just think, you know, knowing who you are, knowing what it takes to win at USC, and knowing that you're going to be more physical and more aggressive, and, you know, you're going to play faster, and you're going to do all those things that great USC football teams do. I think that's the key, and what the, you know, what exactly that, you know, you call that in terms of coaching. I think you just have to, you know who you are, know how you're going to win football games, and know when a push comes to shove, unlike last year, that you're going to be able to make the play, the big play at the end of the game, and that's kind of a belief system that you, you know, that in all of Pete's teams that felt like that and could do that, all believed that that occurred in practice, that they learned that ability to believe in themselves by the way they went at it in practice and the way they went at it against one another. And, you know, that was an awful lot of the genius in Pete. You know, people would say, oh, they make great halftime adjustments, or they do that. No, they practice so well. And their practices so prepared them for the game situations that they weren't, you know, afraid to make the big play when it had to happen. And that's what we didn't see enough of last year in those four losses. That's, I think, the thing that has to happen this year.
All right. Makes sense. Thanks for that question. All the way from Fresno. Al came down last year and got to see me on the sidelines of the spring game, but we were up in the press box this year, so I didn't get to see Al. But hopefully you enjoyed the trip down and enjoyed the game. I think it was a little more exciting than the one from last year. Well, hopefully next year it'll be like a full-on spring game Like, you got to
see. I think they actually listened to that. I think they tried harder to put on a show with the numbers. And I think they wanted, and yet they also stuck with their, you know, with the idea that they were going to get Max Brown plenty of work and get him kind of a game situation. I mean, he's a lot more prepared, I think, to take the team over now than he was before the spring game. So they didn't back off of that. And I like that a lot.
Well, let's go to James. He says, if the personnel issues in the defensive line do not appear to be getting solved early in preseason camp, are there any of the offensive linemen that would be candidates to switch over? I believe it's normally done the other way, defense to offense, but seems like if plugging the interior tackle box area is a problem, they would be able to make use of some of that depth to address if needed. That's from James.
James, you think like I do, but I've had absolutely no luck over the years whatsoever in getting anybody to make that switch, I don't think. I'm trying to think if there was anybody. I mean, one guy I wanted to see him do it with is John Martinez, for example, wasn't going to start at, you know, offensive guard. I wanted to see him, you know, give him a shot at nose tackle or wherever with his, you know, quickness and strength and leverage and all that. Didn't get any help there. On this group, you know, you don't want to kind of start taking away from guys, but you look at Khalil Rogers and you look at Jordan Simmons and you say, you know, both of them could probably, play D-line if they really wanted to. I mean, kids become specialists so early now that you just don't see that happening much. But I do think there'd be a couple of candidates, although Khalil is, if he's going to be, you know, the number two center, that would be an issue. Jordan just kind of rounding back into form, but I do think, there are a couple of guys that, they could make that switch if they had to. I wouldn't give up on the three guys who were sitting out spring. I think they've got a shot at being there, you know, in August. And so we'll see. But it's a good thought.
Cody Temple is a guy that switched over. He's in there now.
I guess I didn't ever consider him an offensive lineman. I always thought, and when I looked at him from the very first day, he just did not look like he was ever going to be an offensive lineman. And you're right. I never did mark him down as an absolute offensive lineman. He always looked like a nose tackle to me.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, let's go to Melvin. Had a couple questions here. Since spring practice is now over, what is the official status of the coaches and players in regards to the relationship between coaches and players interacting with each other with things like watching film, conditioning, and physical workouts?
That's a good question. I mean, they certainly see the strength and conditioning guys a lot. I mean, they probably see them more even off, you know, in season, they may see him more. They certainly are going to see him more now. I know they added a couple of hours a week that they could have in the summer sessions with the coaches, direct kind of coaching kind of work, at least meetings and get-togethers. I don't know when that starts. That's a good question as to, you know, when does it start? Does it start, you know, before the, you know, season, before the, you know, semester is over? I don't know. I'll find out about that.
Yeah, Dan, in general, it's about 8 hours. I think it's 8 hours a week that the strength coaches can work with the players. And then there's certain times when the other coaches can kind of get involved. But throughout the whole summer, there can never be footballs used, so the players have to do their own kind of workout. So there's no more players, coaches, and footballs until fall camp starts. But there are, you know, it's about 8 hours a week, I think what the rule is for strength coaches, and they can do stuff on the field, they can do stuff in the weight room. And then at some point, like Dan mentioned, the coaches can kind of get out there as well. They can run through things and do stuff with the position coaches and, you know, and the head coach and everything. But like I said, no footballs allowed in those summer workouts.
Yeah, I think they let them do 2 hours, was the change maybe a year ago that they allowed that to happen. I think they knew, you know, I mean, guys are allowed to meet with the coaches, and, you know, so they're meeting in the, you know, the coach's office or the meeting room or whatever. So they just said, you know, you can actually coach them a couple of hours. And that's hardly, you know, an overemphasis at all. Yeah. But, yeah.
They get to do something, so, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there's more. When that starts is a good question. I don't know if it's you know, if that rule was put in just for the summer, or if that's a rule that, you know, goes, you know, that starts up, for example, as soon as spring practice is over. I don't know that.
Yeah, we can find out and then and let you know. They change it a little bit every once in a while, but in general, about 8 hours a week with the strength coaches, and the regular coaches can do some too. He also wanted to know, what about the coaches recruiting at this time? Any dead periods, or can they go out and visit players? And they just actually started the May evaluation period, which I think starts April 15th and goes like 6 weeks. So Gerard was posting a lot of – we post stuff in the war room, and Gerard posted a lot on the Peristyle about where the coaches were going. They, you know, the old staff used to make a lot of phone calls that first day, that contact period of evaluation. And, you know, like whatever, 6 in the morning or whatever time you could call. This staff kind of went out and hit the road, and everyone was traveling and going to different schools. And when the high schools have spring practices, you can go check them out. But they can't go, like, interview the kid or anything like that on campus. But they can go check things out. The kids know that, you know, they'll talk to the coaches and the players, the, you know, prospects know. The coaches were there, and offers go out. And like you saw, you know, USC got 3 commitments over the last 3 days of last week. So a lot of kind of stuff is happening right now. So it's definitely not a dead period. This is, they call it the May evaluation period, and the coaches are out on the road and checking out all these prospects out.
Yeah, I think the number GM had, and I thought it was a good number, that the average USC coach is going to be on the road about 18 days the first month after spring ball.
Oh, wow.
So that's a good bit. I mean, and some of that's here, where, you know, they'll start today at, you know, a local high school or wherever. And, you know, as we've seen, some of that's paid off already.
And then he had one last one. Between now and fall enrollment and practice for the incoming freshmen, can those incoming freshmen use USC facilities for conditioning and looking at film during the summer months? That's
we've
a good question,
seen
too.
Them here. We know they're we've seen them work out at times, but I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, I'm not really sure, because they're, like, usually you see them once they graduate, and then they kind of get, not officially involved, but they come out, and they'll go through the summer workouts and stuff, and I think they'll start, a lot of times they'll start the summer session and start classes, and I think at that point, you can kind of get things going, similar to what the early enrollees do when they enroll and start up. But I'm not 100% sure, like, what capacity to go in there. But we usually start seeing them in June working, like, at least unofficially working out with the team, because that's, like, after they graduate, then they kind of make their way to USC a lot of times.
Yeah, and it's all unofficial. I mean, you know, the university doesn't have anything to do with it. The coaches can't, you know, set the schedules, and there's no required attendance and all that. So, you know, it's and then guys work out on their own, not necessarily at USC. And, you know, anybody can show up at those, I think, without a doubt. So it's pretty informal in a lot of ways. I would think last summer was the least informal ever. I thought that was really run well.
Yeah.
When you considered all the freshmen that were involved, and there was a lot of learning going on, and a lot of they got a lot of stuff done last summer with those freshmen. So, but as far as can they watch film, that's a good question.
Yeah, I'm not
sure.
I would think you could just go up there in the office. I don't think there's any kind of, you know, rule against you can't come watch film with the. I mean, you know, you can invite members of the media to come up and watch film, so I don't see why you couldn't invite someone that's enrolling in your school.
Yeah, I just thought you can't schedule them for that, but if they would come on their own, and asked to do that, I'm sure that, you know, I'm sure that they'd be allowed to do that.
Yeah. Well, we're going to switch gears a little bit, Dan, because we did have, like I said, a lot of questions about the Reggie Bush stuff and the, you know, Pat Hayden and Todd McNair and the NCAA. So there might be some overlap here. So I'll try to get to the voicemail ones first. And we do have a lot of people wrote in, and we'll try to get to everyone's questions or at least touch on all the topics that everyone has brought up, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
All right. Well, he'll jump in. Let's do a voicemail question to start. Here you go.
Hey, Ryan. This is Mario from Whittier, California. I had a question for you and Dan. Recently, Pat Hayden was asked if he'll ever welcome back Reggie Bush to USC, and his answer was absolutely. From what I heard at the time when all the sanctions came down, USC was supposed to permanently disassociate them from Reggie Bush. Now that the unsealed documents are out, do you feel like Reggie Bush will actually step foot on USC campus, or from all the drama in the past that he's just done with USC and the whole NCAA mess? I'd like to get you guys' thoughts on that. Thanks, man. Love the show.
Hey, Mario. You know, there's been, I mean, America loves, you know, kind of forgiving and, you know, forgetting and all that, but you have to pretty much have kind of an act of contrition, I think, a little bit there. You know, you had a situation where it didn't seem like anybody listened to anybody and that nobody helped anybody. You know, I don't think, you know, Reggie helped USC or himself, and USC probably didn't help the situation either. So I guess you could see a situation where it made sense for everybody to make up. And I, you know, again, you'd love to see a situation where, you know, where USC tells the NCAA, you know, we were penalized for 3 years. You can't penalize anybody, you know, till the day you die. I mean, nobody gets a penalty like that. I mean, does the NCAA even have the power to do that? The neat thing about it is these kids now that are coming along 10 years after Reggie played are still talking about Reggie Bush. It was the one thing Paul D got right. He said USC was going to benefit, you know, recruiting because of Reggie. And I don't even know that any of us realized the impact, the lasting impact that was going to have. I mean, we laughed at, you know, Paul D was an idiot in some ways because he said, you know, Reggie was this high-profile player, blah, blah, blah. He was only the second, you know, Heisman Trophy guy in the USC backfield that year. He was one of eight people on the cover of the media guy going into his senior year to act like Reggie Bush was the highest profile player on the USC team was a joke. I mean, it just made you aware of how much the NCAA didn't have any idea what was going on. But if there were a way to do that, you know, that would be fine. And obviously nobody, you know, I mean, the NCAA, let's face it, the NCAA has people who, for the USC case, should be penalized for life more than Reggie Bush. So I would think USC ought to use that in ways in which they could, you know, get after the NCAA. The NCAA's got a lot to hide, a lot to cover up, and a lot to make up for. And, you know, I don't think USC should back down. So I don't mind Pat doing that. I just think that Reggie would be way down my list of things for USC to get back from the NCAA. There are a whole lot of other things that I'd like to see the USC have the NCAA address before Reggie Bush. But, you know, if they can get Reggie back and Reggie wants to be back and Reggie wants to, you know, talk about, gosh, I wish I would have been, you know, a little more of this or a little more of that when all this happened, that'd be great.
It's funny that if people haven't listened to, we did a second podcast last week with Matt Leinart, came on and talked about half an hour. And I mentioned that to him about, you know, we talked about Reggie Bush and how big of an influence he still is on recruiting. And it's like Matt Leinart won the Heisman, maybe the greatest quarterback in USC history, one of the great of college football history. But people don't say, I want to come to USC because of Matt Leinart. They still say because of Reggie Bush. And he acknowledged that. He knew that, too. It's just the kind of special dynamic player he was.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. I mean, these are kids that were 7 and 8 years old when Reggie was playing at USC. So that's amazing.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go to Bill had a question. He said, there are some 200 emails, I think it means 200 pages of emails, from the NCAA Bush investigation that have not been released. Can you give us an idea of when these will be released and why these emails were held out of the batch that has been released? And also, I've always felt that the entire investigation was a sham and the results were predetermined. The committee, except for quote-unquote fat boy, I think he was talking about Paul D, were nothing more than dupes that were led around in the dark by D. The power brokers at the NCAA were behind the whole thing. They were behind the whole thing, as were the conference commissioners such as Slive and Delaney. Larry Scott was the new kid on the block, and he got schooled by some of the folks trying to gain a competitive advantage. They ran a double reverse, getting us to focus on the potato head lady. And potato head lady? Josephine Petuto. Okay. Trying to get these nicknames here, and Missy Conboy, while the real villains were those advisors, non-voting people who were placed there out of sight and with no apparent judging role, just to get the power brokers' predetermined results. Dan, am I delusional? That's from Bill.
No, I think they were predetermined. I don't think there's any question about that. The NCAA staff, after the longest investigation in history, had to come up with a conviction and a serious, serious penalty, worse than the Miami penalty, the Alabama penalty. And you could tell from some of the emails we have seen that the staff, was a little bit under the gun. They were, not happy, the Committee on Infractions, or at least those guys that, technically weren't supposed to be voting and influencing people. We're not too happy that the investigators hadn't come up with anything, and you could tell the pressure that everybody was under. I think you may be giving D too much credit as well. I mean, I think D was, I think they were all led around by the, the three guys that we now. I mean, I think there was suspicion of that, but there was no proof of it. And every time it would be brought up, they would deny it. They would say things like, the only time they had any influence on this or had any ability to, have a, any look at what was going on was, they would correct things for typos or whatever. Well, now we know that was totally not true. They weren't telling the truth. But it does look like the committee, and we had Missy Conboy tell an alumni group, a Notre Dame alumni group in Florida, that the committee kind of got hijacked. She didn't know that there was a USC guy in the audience. And so I think they've already kind of admitted. I mean, basically right now, I think most of the people on the Committee on Infractions for USC case would do anything to be able to say, it wasn't our fault. We didn't realize, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they're trying to dance their way out of it. So I don't think you're delusional at all, except that, honestly, I don't think Paul D was as much of an, he was the front guy who turned out to be the worst possible front guy they could have ever had. They made a rule after the USC case. The rule was, for an hour, they would do a press conference when the ruling comes down, and the chairman of the committee would answer questions for an hour. As soon as that was over, the NCAA decided, we're never going to let that happen again. And Paul D had pretty much disgraced himself. A lot of references to the Miami case, and who knew even what was coming with the next Miami case. But I do think the NCAA staff and the non-voting members hijacked the process. I don't think there's any question about that. And that the result came first, then the penalties, and then they thought they would be able to find the evidence, and that was their problem. The evidence wasn't there. They had to make it up. They had to change the evidence that they got to even, you know, approach, and they still couldn't really come up with almost anything. So, yeah, so you're not delusional, but I wouldn't give D that much credit.
All right, let's go to another voicemail question for you, Dan. Here you go.
Good day, Ryan. My name is Phil Trigg, Northern Virginia. I just have a question. What is it going to take to get Pat Hayden off his butt and go after the NCAA? Dan Weber wrote an excellent article challenging Pat to move forward quickly. If we don't move forward, this is just going to get swept under the rug, and the NCAA will continue to do what they do. If anything, if Pat isn't healthy enough to go after him, hire somebody. A good example might be Coach McNair's legal team. Hire them. They seem to be pretty adept at going after the NCAA. Just concerned that we have the advantage and nothing's being done.
Well, I think, you know, back in Northern Virginia there, I think you see it, you know, fairly clearly. Except for this. Here's my take on it. I don't know that USC needed to sue or needs to sue now or needs to do any of that, but they don't need to take it off the table. They don't need to tell anybody they're not going to do this or they're not going to do that. I mean, I just think you have to, you know, keep everything on the table and keep everything a possibility, and you don't meekly accept it. When you look at the results that, you know, happened, I know people are still saying, oh, the NCAA would have held a grudge, and the NCAA, da-da-da, and they were still, and yet you look at, did they hold a grudge against Ohio State or Oregon or, you know, North Carolina or Miami? I mean, they can't hold a grudge. If they get caught holding a grudge, they would be in more trouble than they're in now. I just think there were opportunities for USC to make some aggressive plays in defending their case as they came up, after Judge Schaller's ruling, for example. Different places along the way where USC could have maybe parlayed what was coming out and the position the NCAA, I mean, the NCAA, you know, did some dumb things like in the Miami case or the UCLA case on Shabazz Muhammad or whatever, where they said something or they had one thing go wrong. But in the USC case, you got a whole systematic, you know, case of the NCAA doing many, many, many things wrong. And just, you know, maybe if all you're doing is defending your players, if all you're doing is defending your alumni, if all you're doing is defending your coaches, if all you're doing is defending, you know, any Todd McNair, for example, you know, what if you just decide he's gotten really screwed and you go, you figure out ways in which you could use the things that came along and are still coming along that could benefit USC. As Brody Boy on the Peristyle points out, there are two different cases, and they absolutely are. The USC case is not the Todd McNair case, and the Todd McNair case is more clear-cut. But I think if you look at the – and Todd's got really smart lawyers, and Bruce Borlett, I think, made the case in the very first hearing when he said the reason the NCAA did what it did to Todd McNair and had to do what it did to Todd McNair was that was the only way they could justify the penalties they gave USC. So you could say there are two completely different cases, but they are related. I think without a doubt, they knew that they had to show a connection. It would have been impossible, as much as they wanted to take USC down the way they did if they would have said there was no connection between anyone at USC and what was going on with Reggie Bush. None whatsoever. They couldn't go there. So I think USC could have used much of what happened with the Todd McNair part of the case to defend itself. How that would have played out, I think the suggestion that Todd's lawyers really figured out some things that the NCAA didn't realize, and they set some traps for the NCAA. They got the NCAA to a place the NCAA's never had to go before in defending itself and this whole process. I would have probably liked to have seen USC see if they could consult with the people that are handling the McNair case and what the legal ethics are there, and can you represent both McNair and USC and all of that. I really don't know, but I would have liked to have seen them get some of that kind of consulting from people who were successfully taking on the NCAA.
Yeah, it could have been some parallel action for sure. I mean, just at least kind of work together at some if as much as you can.
Yep.
All right. David had a question. Someone who seems to be in a position to know tells me that Pat Hayton had wanted to do more, be more aggressive with the NCAA, but was prohibited from doing so by Max Nikias, the USC president. Has Dan heard anything like that, David?
You know, we hear so many things. It's so hard to tell. I mean, Pat's, really a good soldier if that's the case, because he hasn't indicated that in a way. He really makes the case that it would have been hard to do, and it would have been hard to prove economic damages, and it just, there were so many, ways in which, and it's tough. If you're Pat, and the first thing you come out and pretty much say is that, we're going to try to do things the right way, and then you find out everybody else in college football is probably doing them in a worse way than USC, and you end up with two of the major felons that followed USC who got slapped on the wrist, Oregon and Ohio State, end up playing in the first ever, college football playoff championship game. And, with 85 scholarships, and they just moved right on and, barely a blip on their, football program with what you saw happen at USC. So, just saying it's unfair, now we know it really was unfair. I mean, I think the biggest mistake for me looking at the USC case from the USC perspective was that they did not aggressively, once Judge Schaller gave his ruling in November 2012, that was the time for USC publicly, privately, in every way they could to exert pressure. They should not have had to wait, almost 2.5 years to see those emails. I mean, they should have demanded from the NCAA in every way possible, and without saying that there would be a limit on what USC would do if they didn't get to see those emails. They should have said, we need to see them. The only independent jurist who's taken a look at them, has talked about, what they were, what happened in this case, and it wasn't fair, and it was malicious. And, unfair to Todd McNair, unfair to USC. And I think that's where USC could have gotten the moral high ground fairly quickly in the case and put the NCAA on the defensive. And put the NCAA on the defensive so that when you go ask them to adjust the scholarship situation because of having to go to games with 44 originally recruited scholarship players, where the NCAA would find it much harder to turn you down when you ask for adjustments in the penalty structure and that kind of thing. But USC kept that quiet, didn't put any pressure on the NCAA, the kind of pressure that Ohio State did and Oregon did and North Carolina did and Miami did. Those schools, Auburn, SEC at least, those schools had fairly good results from putting, from being aggressive and putting pressure on the NCAA. USC chose to go the other way. They said, we don't want to look like football is that important to us. We're, in the business of raising $6 billion, and we're, becoming a, great, college campus and a great college research institution and a great academic institution, and we don't want it to look like football is maybe all that important. So we really, it's been not possible to, you know, even if you know people who know people, or you know people who are on the board or were on the board or whatever, those discussions just didn't seem to go outside the board. I mean, it's really been difficult to know where that final decision was made and what exactly, you know, went into making it. And is it, you know, written in stone, or is it still possible that they could decide, even at this late date, that there's a place to make the case for USC? I don't know. I really don't know.
We will see. We keep getting more and more information as the weeks and weeks go on. Slow, but we're getting more. And of course, Dan Weber's been on top of it. Matt had an interesting question, a little different perspective. He said, it's hard to argue that the NCAA fairly punished the USC football program. In fact, it's pretty clear they went overboard with a witch hunt that they will end up regretting. But what about the O.J. Mayo situation? With all the attention on Reggie Bush and football, we all kind of forget about the accusations against the basketball program. What do we know about that situation and how the NCAA reacted? That's from Matt.
Well, I mean, it was different. The NCAA cleared O.J. to come to USC. I mean, and later on, they changed the definition of basically the fellow who was involved in, as an AAU guy involved with, O.J. coming to USC, a Los Angeles-based guy, had been involved 5 years, I guess it was 5 years earlier, in a violation. And no one considered him a representative of USC's athletic interests until in the middle of the case, and the NCAA said, oh, by the way, we've changed the definition for this guy. He's now a representative of USC's athletic interests or whatever. I mean, he did that a couple of times in the case. After, you know, clearing OJ and saying he was okay, he was good to go, I would have probably, and I liked OJ personally a lot. You know, I mean, here's a kid, you know, everybody said, oh, he was getting this and he was getting that, you know, and he drove a green bicycle around. One of the reasons he was still involved with that guy was he needed a ride when they wanted, you know, if they were going to go to UCLA or wherever around town to play in the summer. OJ didn't have a car. But that was settled separately pretty much. That was a case where USC self-sanctioned for OJ, and the NCAA accepted those. They probably over-sanctioned themselves when they gave up that entire recruiting class of a team that might have, you know, been a Final Four team if they'd have kept them all. But I don't think if you take a look at what OJ's situation was and compare it to a lot of the big-time programs right now, you know, OJ was so small potatoes. And OJ was a good student. He worked real hard. You know, he stayed in school so that USC wouldn't lose, out on the, you know, the APR, you know, when he left. He finished up his second semester. So I don't have any really bad, you know, feelings about OJ. I do think USC should have probably paid a little more attention to the fellow that, you know, delivered him to USC, and probably would have, you know, been a little more arm's length relationship there, just because of whatever, you know. And then it turns out you wouldn't have given the NCAA a chance to change the definition and try to make it look worse than it was. But I think they were pretty separate.
We got a few more we'll try to squeeze in here. Abel says, Dan, I mostly follow you via the Peristyle podcast. Just curious if there's been any movement on the the documentary by Scott Conrad now that the veil has been removed on the NCAA. And just one comment to vent frustration. Where are Pete Thamel and Dan Wetzel Wetzel was a key player in fabricating a story to bring down USC, and since the release of the emails, not a single comment has been made. That's from Abel.
Yeah, I think he would. I think Wetzel would really like to put that way behind him, because Yahoo did that essentially to try to, you know, they were getting started, and they wrote every story with the lead graph to the effect that Reggie Bush could cost USC their national championship and Reggie Bush's Heisman, because they knew, you know, just agent involvement, you know, like that wasn't that big a deal, or an amateurism violation wasn't that big a deal. But if they could tie it to USC losing a national championship, that was a big deal. So they decided, and probably basically for their own good, to try to make it a bigger deal than it was. And so they did. And I would think right now Wetzel would probably not want to talk about that very much. Why the New York Times hasn't gotten involved in this? I mean, they did join the lawsuit to get the information released and made public. And I mean, you know, part of the problem, and this is, we found out that this is somewhat the case, it's hard to come in on a situation where essentially what you would be doing is kind of righting the wrong and defending USC. I mean, the facts are the facts. And if, you know, USC got, you know, really screwed by the NCAA, if you're going to do that story and do it properly, you're basically going to defend USC. Problem is, USC hasn't chosen yet almost, you know, in any way to defend USC. And it's hard to defend somebody that won't defend itself or that won't really speak up for itself. So, Gabe, if you wanted to do a big story and you had maybe, you know, the one, you know, statement that USC released and that was about it, that's hard. I mean, if USC, if you say, well, what are you going to do? Oh, well, I think, I don't know. It's, so you put these people who might do more or say more in a difficult spot because you're not doing more or saying more as USC. So that's been, you know, kind of the problem all along. I think the LA Times was really missed the boat for years. They had a kind of an attitude that, USC this and USC that, and they just didn't pick up on it and weren't paying attention. And when they did, they were kind of negative. And they certainly had, you know, the manpower and the ability to get the story done if they would have wanted to, but they didn't want to. And again, USC didn't help by not pushing, on that story. I think those are places where, you know, if you have, is there a criticism of USC? Maybe not being a little more public and a little more pro its own athletes and its own coaches. I mean, the kids that came through USC then that weren't allowed to go to bowl games, who were completely innocent, that were made to play and practice with way fewer players than anybody they were playing, that they didn't back off at all, they didn't schedule down, they didn't, you know, run away from anything. I think USC owed them more to stand up, you know, for them and to fight for them and to say, look, this isn't right and something ought to be done about it. And that just didn't happen.
All right, let's go to Earl in West L.A. He says, Dan Weber always seems to provide insightful commentary and perspective. I just heard him say last Monday on the podcast that Larry Scott is smart enough to know he needs to do some fence mending with USC. The next day, I read in the L.A. Times that Scott criticized the NCAA's investigation and punishment of USC. Scott was quoted by Gary Klein as saying, we've maintained from the beginning the USC case is a good example of how the current enforcement system is not fair and consistent across the board. I could swear he and the rest of the conference have been quiet as church mice on this issue. Was he ever publicly quoted as saying this at any time in the last 6 years? Love the show. Keep it going. Fight on, Earl in West L.A.
Earl, I actually talked to Larry Scott a couple of times about it. At first, I don't think he knew what to say. And USC had Lane as the coach, and everybody was, you know, worried about Lane to begin with. And then we got him at the halftime of a game a couple of years ago. And all he could say was, you know, we don't like it, but it's hard to not agree with the NCAA's kind of ruling where every Committee on Infractions case is its own case. And he said, that's how they've justified everything they've done to USC, is they've said, there are no precedents. There are no precedents for judging these cases. There are no precedents for penalties that these each Committee on Infractions group can be independent of every other group. And so we don't think they did the right thing, but they had the right to do it. You know, I tend to agree they didn't do the right thing. I also tend to agree they didn't have the right to do it the way they did it. But it was like a bad thing happened, you know, from Larry's, the way Larry saw it, a really bad thing happened to USC, and that's just too bad. Sorry about that. And it did fit in with his feelings that he made really clear when he got here, that he didn't like USC and the 11 Dwarfs, or the USC and the 9 Dwarfs, and he wanted to change that. And he did, certainly it seems, you know, their staff probably has more people from Cal. They're, you know, 8 miles from Berkeley. And Larry certainly seemed to cozy up to Stanford in a few situations. And he certainly seemed, whenever he got the chance, to come down hard on USC. I mean, if he didn't have a USC player to suspend, there wouldn't have been anybody, you know, or not suspend necessarily, but, you know, call out. I mean, called out Matt Barkley. I mean, imagine you had a case involving Matt Barkley and Vontaze Burfict, and you came down on Vontaze Burfict's side against Matt Barkley. Are you kidding me? I mean, and at the time, USC couldn't help him. You know, he didn't have to rule, for example, that USC wasn't allowed in 2011 to play in the first ever championship game. USC could have played in that game, and the Pac-12 could have let him. Sure, the Pac-12 would have been taking a chance that USC might have won. Hey, they'd already beaten Oregon once, but Larry wasn't going to take that chance, even if it was, you know, now we know, you know, unfair to those USC kids. They deserved the right to, you know, they weren't going to get a bowl game, but they certainly had earned the right to be in that championship game. But that wasn't going to happen, and I don't think we're going to hear an apology from Larry about that. But yeah, they've been kind of quiet. And, again, you hear the both stories. One story is that USC wants them to be, or has wanted them to be, or that would make USC put USC in a place where they don't want to be. And the other story is that they're happy as can be to not have to make that case, because the other 11 schools in the Pac-12 are just as happy that USC got slapped down, and they don't want to be reminded of, you know, that it wasn't a fair, you know, fair process.
All right, we got one last one for you, Dan, and then we have a basketball question. One last, Todd McNair. Simple one from Terry. And what exactly is the status of the Todd McNair lawsuit, and what's the next move?
Well, the status is the court will decide if they're going to dismiss. You know, Todd McNair's lawyers wanted the NCAA's motion. I guess the NCAA wanted to appeal the decision to, their dismissal. I guess Todd's lawyers said the NCAA's appeal should be dismissed, and we should hear the merits of the case, whereas because they didn't file a complete record, they withheld those 200 pages. Whether there'll be a hearing on that, both sides have filed their, you know, briefs or their motions or whatever they call them. Whether there'll be a hearing on that, there are a lot of people who think that court will just rule and they'll move to the next phase, which is they're going to set a hearing date for the case on the appeal on its merits. What everybody that observes the court says is the NCAA is going to lose on that. This case is not going to get dismissed. And that at that point, it'll go back to Los Angeles Superior Court for trial. There are those who say that could happen, you know, by the end of the summer. And that at that point, the McNair's attorneys, we understand, and we can only imagine, they've only gotten discovery. Well, let's say they've gotten limited discovery for the motion where the NCAA said we wanted to dismiss the case. They don't have a case, and it's just free speech, and we're allowed to say what we want to say. That they got limited discovery, McNair's attorneys did. One member of the Committee on Infractions, several staff members, that's pretty much it. If it goes to trial, they will get full discovery, and they will be able to depose all of the rest of the people. I think of the 8 voting members, 7 would be deposed, and they'd be able to depose all of the members of the Infractions Appeals Committee and a number of other people on the NCAA staff that haven't been, and probably former members of the NCAA staff. At that point, I've heard from, you know, attorneys who said, there is no way that the NCAA can let that happen. They absolutely can't afford to have those people be deposed. And I would tend to agree as well. So will the NCAA, you know, pony up the money and just say we can't go, you know, any further down this road? We stalled as long as we could. We stalled and lost because those 500 pages came out. I still don't think we know exactly what the mechanics of the other 200 pages coming out, how that will work. And they've been arguing over what the language that the court gave the NCAA, where they said that the NCAA could decide what record to file in their appeal. And McNair's attorney said that meant they either filed everything or they didn't file anything. And the NCAA said, no, this gives us the right to pick which 500 pages we want to file and which 200 we don't want to file. So the court has to decide that first. And then they go to the merits of the appeal where they're appealing Judge Schaller's ruling. And I don't think they have a shot at winning that. So that means it goes back to L.A. And they get ready for trial. And it's impossible to imagine that the NCAA lets that happen. It would be brutal beyond belief. If what's happened already looks bad, I think it would get worse. And just the drip, drip, drip of more bad information and more bad and more embarrassing information about these people who have in the past been very proud, you know, that they represent their institution and their law professors and they're on the NCAA Committee on Infractions. Well, in the future, that isn't going to be a resume enhancer. And these people are not going to want you to know they were even on the USC case. I mean, I think most of the people on the USC case right now, if they had their druthers, if they could erase their name from that case, they would. And so, you know, anything that keeps that case alive and keeps it, you know, out in the public eye, they can't want that to happen. So, but that's what happens next after we assume that they're going to lose on appeal on the merits of the case. Because the ruling Judge Schaller issued in the NCAA case, I mean, you know, now that you read the emails, you can't possibly, you know, defend the fact that they they don't have a good shot at winning a defamation lawsuit against the NCAA. And
right.
that's what, in order for the case to be dismissed, you'd pretty much have to say they got no case whatsoever. Well, it's obvious they've got a case.
Yeah.
So they're not going to get this case dismissed. And where that goes, we can only hope. I mean, that would be a summer of unbelievable interesting fun if that case went to court in L.A.
We'd be all over that. So we'll.
I can't even imagine how interesting that would be, how ugly that would be for the NCAA.
All right, well, Dan, we're going to end it on. Maybe it's not, but it might be our first ever women's basketball question. And I didn't know what was going on here. You might be more aware of what's up, but I'll play the question for you and let you answer if you can. Here you go.
Hi, this is Richard D., USC basketball fan, and as many concerns as I have for the men's program, I had a disturbing thing come up the other day about the women's basketball team where two of their stars, freshmen, are transferring out. They had another one transfer out at the beginning of the season, and they had another one dismissed from the university after getting arrested before the season. I know Cynthia Cooper is a good coach, but I'm wondering if you guys have any comments on this or what is going on. They only have six returning players back. My daughter follows SC basketball really well. So if you have any insights, I'd sure appreciate it. And fight on. Enjoy the show. Thanks again. Bye.
I wish I could help you. I can't. I know I've tried to watch some USC women's basketball games, and I think I'm spoiled by those great USC women's basketball programs that were, you know, the best teams in America at the start, you know, when women's college basketball was really getting off to, you know, to become a national sport. And you go watch them now and you realize, you know, if you can't stay with, you know, the Oregon States of this world and all that, it reminds you too much of the men's team. And so I don't know the details you're talking about. I know they've had problems, and you know that people kind of have a good feeling, you know, about the coach, but it isn't showing up on the floor. And you would think USC, you know, in a sport where it is more about getting your education and, you know, having a great school to go to, than it is about getting ready to play, you know, professional basketball. You'd think USC have kind of a natural advantage in terms of all the, you know, recruiting possibilities and, you know, the location and the school itself. And we don't see that happening. So I think we'll probably be paying a little more attention next year to, you know, to see where this goes. But, you know, they haven't had much luck the last couple of years on either side of the ball with regard to basketball. But you're telling me some things I don't think I know firsthand. So we'll have to check those out.
Yeah, we can. And I think Shotgun is usually – he knows Cynthia Cooper pretty well. They talk a lot. I guess she's a big football recruiting fan. Like, she knows what's going on with football recruiting, which is kind of funny. But if you want to go to the Peristyle, just on uscfootball.com and maybe ask that question there, we can have Shotgun kind of – he probably knows a little bit more what's going on, but we could look into it as well. But I had no idea. I'd never even heard of that. We just don't follow women's basketball all that much. I'm sorry. You know, football kind of takes us 365 days a year. Yeah. That's what people care most about. So that's,
I mean, I think the thing you want is to have a – women's basketball program that demands that you pay them some attention, and that we don't probably is not a good thing. I mean, you know, men's obviously baseball this year,
yeah,
has kind of demanded that you really pay attention to them, and I think that's what the other sports, you know, and obviously, I mean, I'll as much as I can, you know, with the women's tennis team or the men's tennis team, and you watch them and you know, they got a chance to win a national championship or the women's golf team or whatever, and you'll watch them, and the water polo teams and all that. I do think, you know, because those teams have developed the way they have, it's hard if you're one of the kind of non-revenue sports that doesn't get up there and has a chance to really be something special. So,
hey, didn't the women's basketball team win like the Pac-12 tournament a year or two ago? I think they might have.
I think they got hot. I'm trying to think, did they actually win it? I know.
Or make it to the finals or
played
something?
Played at USC. I think one year they played it at USC. And I think, I'm not sure who was the coach then. I don't think they've, you know, reached that, you know, level since then. And I don't, you know, we look at it and you're not sure why, that they just don't seem to be. I think the last time I saw them.
Okay. Yeah. I just Googled it just for real quick. It's 2014. They beat Oregon State to win the first Pac-12 tournament championship. So, okay. So they, that was nice that they did that last year.
Okay.
Yeah. But do we know what's going on with transfers and stuff? I'm sorry. We do not.
No,
not our area of expertise, but we can, we can look into it and you know, definitely.
Well, that was last year. Okay, so that, again, tells you that, you know, maybe our fault, maybe their fault, that you didn't have that sense of them, you know, because I'm not sure. Did they go to the tournament?
Yeah.
They had to.
Well, in 2014, they did. I don't remember what they did in the NCAA tournament, but they did because they won.
I don't remember that at all.
Yeah.
Wow.
Crazy.
Okay.
All right. Well, we'll look at it.
Definitely have to study up on that a little bit more.
Yeah. And check on the Peristyle, ask Shotgun, and he probably knows what's going on. But we can start a thread and discuss it, and I think other people will be able to chime in as well. So sorry we couldn't give you a better answer than that. But Dan, great long show, but thank you so much for joining us and taking both spots, your spot and Coach Harvey Hyde's spot. So thanks for coming on and answering all the questions.
Answered some of them.
We didn't know all of them, but we did our best. But
we'll try.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Dan, and I hope you guys enjoyed the Peristyle podcast. Don't forget, go back to peristylepodcast.com if you want to hear my interview with USC Heisman winning quarterback Matt Leinart. We did that last week. It's a really good one, so if you want to, you can enjoy that after you listen to this one. So hope you enjoyed the show, and we will talk to you all next week.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your iPod or MP3 player for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.